The Americans in the slaughterhouse had a very interesting visitor 2 days before Dresden was destroyed. He was Howard W. Campbell, Jr., an American who had become a Nazi. Campbell was the one who had written the monograph about the shabby behavior of American prisoners of war. He wasn't doing more research about prisoners now. He had come to the slaughterhouse to recruit men for a German military unit called the Free American Corps. Campbell was the inventor and commander of the unit, which was supposed to fight only on the Russian front. Campbell was an ordinary-looking man, but he was extravagantly costumed in a uniform of his own design. He wore a white 10-gallon hat and black cowboy boots, decorated with swastikas and stars. He was sheathed in a blue body stocking, which had yellow stripes running from his armpits to his ankles. His shoulder patch was a silhouette of Abraham Lincoln's profile on a field of pale green. He had a broad armband, which was red, with a blue swastika in a circle of white. He was explaining this armband now in the cement block hog barn. Billy Pilgrim had a boiling case of heartburn, since he had been spooning malt syrup all day long at work. The heartburn brought tears to his eyes, so that his image of Campbell was distorted by jiggling lenses of salt water. "Blue is for the American sky," Campbell was saying. "White is for the race that pioneered the continent, drained the swamps and cleared the forests and built the roads and bridges. Red is for the blood of American patriots, which was shed so gladly in years gone by." Campbell's audience was sleepy. It had worked hard at the syrup factory, and then it had marched a long way home in the cold. It was skinny and hollow-eyed. Its skins were beginning to blossom with small sores. So were its mouths and throats and intestines. The malt syrup it spooned at the factory contained only a few of the vitamins and minerals every earthling needs. Campbell offered the Americans food now, steaks and mashed potatoes and gravy and mince pie, if they would join the Free American Corps. "Once the Russians are defeated," he went on, "you will be repatriated through Switzerland." There was no response. "You're going to have to fight the communists sooner or later," said Campbell. "Why not get it over with now?" And then it developed that Campbell was not going to go unanswered after all. Poor old Derby, the doomed high school teacher, lumbered to his feet for what was probably the finest moment in his life. There are almost no characters in this story, and almost no dramatic confrontations, because most of the people in it are so sick and so much the listless playthings of enormous forces. One of the main effects of war, after all, is that people are discouraged from being characters. But old Derby was a character now. His stance was that of a punch-drunk fighter. His head was down. His fists were out front, waiting for information and battle plan. Derby raised his head, called Campbell a snake. He corrected that. He said that snakes couldn't help being snakes, and that Campbell, who could help being what he was something much lower than a snake or a rat, or even a blood-filled tick. Campbell smiled. Derby spoke movingly of the American form of government, with freedom and justice and opportunities and fair play for all. He said there wasn't a man there who wouldn't gladly die for those ideals. He spoke of the brotherhood between the American and the Russian people, and how those two nations were going to crush the disease of Nazism, which wanted to infect the whole world. The air raid sirens of Dresden howled mournfully. The Americans and their guards and Campbell took shelter in an echoing meat locker, which was hollowed in living rock under the slaughterhouse. There was an iron staircase with iron doors at the top and bottom. Down in the locker were a few cattle and sheep and pigs and horses hanging from iron hooks. So it goes. The locker had empty hooks for thousands more. It was naturally cool. There was no refrigeration. There was candlelight. The locker was whitewashed and smelled of carbolic acid. There were benches along the wall. The Americans went to these, brushing away flakes of whitewash before they sat down. Howard W. Campbell, Jr. remained standing, like the guards. He talked to the guards in excellent German. He had written many popular German plays and poems in his time, and had married a famous German actress named Resi North. She was dead now, had been killed while entertaining troops in the Crimea. So it goes. Nothing happened that night. It was the next night that about 130,000 people in Dresden would die. So it goes. Billy dozed in the meat locker. He found himself engaged again, word for word, gesture for gesture, in the argument with his daughter with which this tale began. "Father," she said, "what are we gonna do with you?" And so on. "You know who I could just kill?" she asked. "Who could you kill?" said Billy. "That Kilgore Trout." Kilgore Trout was and is a science fiction writer, of course. Billy has not only read dozens of books by Trout, he has also become Trout's friend, to the extent that anyone can become a friend of Trout, who is a bitter man. Trout lives in a rented basement in Ilium, about 2 miles from Billy's nice white home. He himself has no idea how many novels he has written, possibly 75 of the things. Not one of them has made money. So Trout keeps body and soul together as a circulation man for the Ilium Gazette, manages newspaper delivery boys, bullies and flatters and cheats little kids. Billy met him for the first time in 1964. Billy drove his Cadillac down a back alley in Ilium, and he found his way blocked by dozens of boys and their bicycles. A meeting was in progress. The boys were harangued by a man in a full beard. He was cowardly and dangerous and obviously very good at his job. Trout was 62 years old back then. He was telling the kids to get off their dead butts and get their daily customers to subscribe to the fucking Sunday edition, too. He said that whoever sold the most Sunday subscriptions during the next 2 months would get a free trip for himself and his parents to Martha's fucking Vineyard for a week, all expenses paid. And so on. One of the newspaper boys was actually a newspaper girl. She was electrified. Trout's paranoid face was terribly familiar to Billy, who had seen it on the jackets of so many books. But coming upon that face suddenly in a hometown alley, Billy could not guess why the face was familiar. Billy thought maybe he had known this cracked messiah in Dresden somewhere. Trout certainly looked like a prisoner of war. And then the newspaper girl held up her hand. "Mr. Trout," she said, "if I win, can I take my sister too?"
"Hell no," said Kilgore Trout. "You think money grows on trees?"
Trout, incidentally, had written a book about a money tree. It had $20 bills for leaves. Its flowers were government bonds. Its fruit was diamonds. It attracted human beings who killed each other around the roots and made very good fertilizer. So it goes.